spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Dobro Yo, good morning, good afternoon, good day, good night, good evening, good whatever. I'm your host, the Right Reverend Dr. Dr. Rowe. You're listening to Reality Extraction on Revolution.radio. Yes. Oh, a little bit more. There's our cue. Today is the 31st day of Augustus, 2023, 1700 hours, 6 minutes, and quite windy here on the West Coast. 78 degrees, according to my thermometer. My thermometer, it says 78 degrees. No, it just dropped, 77 degrees, and windy. Windy. Yeah. That means it's 2000 hours. It's 8:07 exactly on the East Coast right now. And 2 a.m. in Central Europe. Hope you're all having a wonderful... This is a long weekend, huh? It's like tomorrow's Friday. And as a crow would say, TGIF. And then you have the weekend. And then here in America, at least, we have some sort of holiday coming up, right? And some sort of... It's like a Labor Day thing. Is it Labor Day? Whatever. I don't even know. Nor do I really care, actually. There's a lot of stuff I don't give a shit about anymore. I'm all out of the, you know, F's to give, as they say, in many aspects. Oh, part of me still holds out. I don't even want to say hope. Hope is like defeatist. I'm going to do nothing and maybe something will get better. Well, I don't know. Maybe the rambling that I've done over the years on the various shows is hit somebody somewhere in a positive way. That's all I can hope for. Oh, there's that word again. That's all I can wish for. And I hope it has. I hope someone is somewhere out there. I don't have to know who or what or when or why. I just, you know, maybe in the afterlife, I'll get a, they'll have a review and then be like, look, this person, you touched their life in this way and you didn't even know it. And I'll be, oh, that was a nice little thing, wasn't it? Is that what? I'm not wishing horrible things upon people. Well, at least not at this moment. Feeling rather empathetically philosophical tonight. I don't know why. Anyway. So here we are at Revolution.radio once again, ladies and gentlemen, and non-binaries, and faux femmes and faux males. Yes. I want to say hey to everybody in our chat room. We got there Pat Krolik, and we got Fleeced Surf. Fleeced Surf, May Street 139, Shermanator, or Green. Can I talk today? Gear Jammer. who else? Cannon Sanders and Comet and Crypt Rick and Mario. Batsman. Batsman. Okay, anybody else? Flippy. There's Flippy. Who else? Feeds. Feeds is back and working, I guess. All right. And a few other folks will probably Futurist. I see Futurist. Let me scroll back down to the current. There's May Street 139. So I think he's alive. I think that Yevgeny Prigozhin is not dead. There's people even talking about doubles, and this other guy's speculating that, yes, Putin tried to take him out, and Prigozhin is using, he's in hiding, and he's got billions of dollars, and he's plotting his revenge against Moscow. Now, I don't subscribe to that particular scenario, but I just, something in me, and I just, you know, my psychic spidey sense, as Keith Arizona would say, I psychically looked at it, and I did. I can do that. I did. And my psychic spidey bro sense says, no, he's still alive. I feel his life force. It's the force, you know, like I can feel him in the force. Something tells me that he still has a role to play in all of this. Is that like from Lord of the Rings? Like Gollum still has a role. Not sure what it is. We don't know what that role is. I don't know if this, I'm citing it right. And I'm not comparing Prigozhin to Gollum. I'm just saying he's got a role in the world stage, and it's not done yet. Maybe he'll pop out. No, once you, I don't know, faked his death. I think he just wants to retire. And then maybe him and his buddies are called the shots from the Dolphin Bay in Namibia or Klein Windhoek. Yeah, and there's a few other places down there in Namibia, probably the most stable country in Africa. Yeah, outside. I mean, we don't count Egypt. Egypt is Middle East. But Africa and Morocco is Europe. This is the way it is. And Israel is Europe, too. That's what they say. And Palestine's Middle East, but Israel's Europe. Morocco is Europe. Or, okay, they're Northern Africa. And Egypt is Middle East. But anyway, I digress. So probably outside of that, one of the most stable countries other than Botswana, which is actually right next to Namibia, is Namibia. And it's got a large German and Dutch population. It also has a large native population, but it also has a lot of land and hardly anybody there. And it's also way the F out of the way. I mean, when's the last time you dealt with anything from Namibia? Now, maybe you've got some jewelry with a diamond in it that came from the De Beers diamond mines where it's the only place in the world where diamonds could be found on the beach. Yeah. And they got it all walled off and secured with guys with machine guns. But nobody's going to go there except really serious people. That's why they have the guys with the machine guns. If you're serious enough to storm the beach of Namibia, you got some resources behind you. And they got these big houses that are like, in California, they'd be tens of millions of dollars. But there, they're like, you know, half a million or whatever. There's, you know, and yes, and there's lions and tigers and bears. There are. It's got quite an interesting geography. In the northern part, it's got some mountainous sort of like African jungly stuff. And then it has a lot of desert. It has a lot of, you know, wide open plain kind of stuff. It has beach. And yeah, it's right next to South Africa, of course, and Botswana and a couple other. But it's way down there. And it's the perfect place if you want to fake your death, go hide. Nobody's going to bother you. Namibia. Yeah. That's on the list, okay? It's on the list. What are we going to talk about tonight? Well, the first hour, I'm going to just ramble about stuff. And, well, you'll find out in a moment. And the second hour probably will run. I don't know if you know who Professor Nita Farahani is, but she goes to a lot of these World Economic Forum, Davos kind of things. And she wrote a book, The Battle for Your Brain. And so there's a conversation with Professor Nita Farahani. And she's got a lot of initials after her name. Her dad is a major cardiologist doctor, and I think she's probably from one of those. So if they're from Iran, but I think they're probably one of those Illuminati bloodline related type group, you know, anyway. So she's like a female Yuval Harari. So we'll hear from that in a second. But, you know, speaking of the World Economic Forum, there's some new technologies. And we'll look at some of those. But first, we are listener supported. I say that Revolution Radio is 100% listener supported. And maybe you don't like me, Maybe there. I don't know why you're listening to me. If you don't like me, but there's a lot of other hosts. It's not just me on this station. I'm on Studio B here, and there's a Studio A. And you're probably, if you're tuning in, you know all this by now. So this is just the standard reminder of, can you please donate, which nobody listens to. I mean, prove me wrong. Okay, we have a Cash App that nobody's ever used. Actually, I think one person's used it. But nobody else has ever used it. RR Tweets, like RRTWEETS, Cash App. It's easy to use. You can go on there. And you can download the app to your iPhone or whatever. Even if you're like over 50, it's not a security risk and all that. It's just like another way of doing things. You got to get with the program, people. I mean, we've got like this younger generation now that's, you know, once you're like two decades apart, you know, like you got the 20-year-olds and lower and lower in high school, and they're using all of this new technologies and. And you're going to sit there and stagnant on your, send an SMS. And they're going to be like, SMS? Sometimes I think about that with talk radio. Like, we're not on the air as far as conventionally, like, broadcast, but we are on the internet. But everybody uses visual. You know, we're a dying breed. People that like to just listen to audio. And but everybody likes that visual stimulation, right? I saw, I'm just mind rambling. I saw this thing where it was a YouTube channel and they tried an experiment where they were going to give away free movie. Or they wanted people to come to their mini movie theater. It was like a kind of a skit, a gig, whatever. But they went out and found people that didn't know anything about it. They really used, you know, real people to get real reactions. So they made this mini movie theater, a couple guys, and they're like, we're going to play classic movies in this. And they're like, well, nobody knows about our movie theater, and they're not going to pay money to come in here, even if they don't know, even if they knew about it yet, because it has no reputation or anything. And they're all, well, what we'll do is we'll go out and we'll find some people and we'll give them like popcorn and drinks for free and say, can we have a couple hours of your time? Would you like to sit down and, you know, watch a movie in our movie theater, and we'll play a classic movie? And it was young people. And they would ask them if we need a list of movies that we can present to people that – so we have movies they've never seen that everybody knows. But they're young enough now where, like, if I tell you what the movie was and that they've never seen it, you'd be like, what? And I remember having a conversation with a girl in Amsterdam, this Romanian girl, and I said, hey, you ever seen Pulp Fiction? You know, everybody saw Pulp Fiction, right? And she said, no, what's that? And of course, I at the time was like, what? You've never seen Pulp Fiction? Oh, we got to go get it right now. Watch the movie. That's not the movie that I'm talking about with the mini movie theater. But that was just, I'm like, wow, you know, because she was considerably younger than me. She was like 18 or something. I was 30-something. Anyway, neither here nor there. So, so they get these people. And the movie, they sit them down. I'm building to a climax here. And the movie was The Godfather, okay? And it's like, that's a long movie. And there's a lot of parts, if you've never seen any, I mean, we all probably, arguably, most of us would agree, The Godfather is one of those really classic, good movies. Something that you would sit down and after a long time might even watch again all the way through. The Godfather, right? I mean, wow. You know Marlon Brando, he put like a prosthesis thing in his lip so that he would talk like with the jaw thing. Anyway. So they sit them down, they give them their popcorn, their candy, and their drinks, and they're watching The Godfather. And you could tell, because there's some parts of the movie that are kind of long drawn out, and I don't want to say boring, but could be boring to some people. And so these young, what do they call them? They're not millennials. The Generation Z, is that? I don't know, whatever they are. The young generation. They're sitting there, and you could tell they're getting squirmy. They're not digging it. It's like, this is boring. Like, what are we doing here? Right? And the people are asking them, like, are you having a good time? And they're all, well, I mean, you know, they're like, give it some time, you know. So they decided, look, maybe we could make it more interesting. And this was part of the experiment. What we'll do is we're going to put another picture in picture Because apparently the younger generation likes stimulus. They like action. They like the short sort of TikTok kind of shorts. Have you noticed YouTube's doing the same thing, shorts? And you get yourself wound up in that. You're like, oh, let's watch this for 30 seconds. Ha, ha, that was cool. Let's see one more. Ha, ha, that was cool. Let's see one more. Ha, ha, that was cool. Let's see. And you get, oh, my God, here I am spending a half an hour looking at YouTube shorts. So, anyways, they took a picture and they put it on the screen of, like, a video game. It was like, yeah, something like Sonic the Hedgehog type of thing, where they've got this multicolored, fast-moving, ball-chasing, jumping, you know, crazy-looking, everything's happening on the screen at one time. And that's in a little box that's in the corner of the screen while the Godfather is playing in the main screen. Now, all of a sudden, they're engaged. They're actually, now you can see they're paying more attention, obviously, to the bouncing, colorful ball game. Little, something's moving, shiny things are moving in the corner, and they were just into it. And then they nobody said anything, just let them, you know, roll with that. And they sat there through the movie. And then they asked him things like, you know, was that more interesting? Oh, yeah, it's definitely more interesting with the video game going. So now, I can, in a way, I can relate, because now I don't know what you want to call me. My mother said I'm hyperactive. Nowadays, they want to say it's ADD, or maybe I'm autistic and don't know it. I don't know, but there's something wacky about my brain. But I need stimulus too sometimes. Like, I can dig quiet. In fact, there's many times I'll be very nice and quiet, you know, and I'm doing my thing and concentrating and being creative or whatever, just enjoying the quiet, da da da. But then probably at least 50% of the time, I might be doing something, concentrating, but I've got something else going on in the background. And I guess a lot of people do that with the TV. They come home from work or school or wherever, they go and they turn on the TV. They won't watch it. They don't even know what channel it's on. Just something's in the blah, 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 blah. They don't know. And that happens to me. I'll start a YouTube video, and then I'll go focus my attention on a web page, and the video might play 20 minutes. I mean, what happened? I don't even know what happened in the video. Maybe my subconscious took it in. Oh, but that's where we need our brain implants. So we could buffer stuff, right? And then, we can download it into our cerebral cortex. Nah, I don't know about that. It's a little bit invasive. Yeah. So, or you play music in the background. That's always, you know, I knew a surgeon, plastic surgeon, that you would play classical music in the operating room. And they say that actually classical music does. Was that what I thought it was? What the heck? Something just occurred. Let me see. But that would have been. Yeah. That was bizarre. It was. Somebody out there is listening. I think we just got a Cash App donation. It'll take a few moments to come through, but I want to say thank you to. I don't see who it was yet. But yeah, there's something pending. Well, thank you very much. From the bottom of our hearts, graciously, thank you. Wow. Well, that was a nice, sweet surprise. Somebody's out there listening. Oh, I better do better. All right. Where was I? Where was I? I don't know. What was I talking about, chat room? Namibia? That was earlier. And it just, the Cash App threw me. But that was a good thing. Let me see if it says who sent it. I don't know if I should say a name on the air, but I don't see it yet. I see that there's something pending. So it usually takes, I think we had one time before, it took like 20 minutes or something. Anyway, all right. If you speak up, well, the squishy wheel gets the squeeze. Multitasking, that's what it was. Thank you. Yes. You don't know you were multitasking, just like I was talking about. Right. Thank you, Pat Rabbit. Doing, like, I'll play something and that. Yeah. I used to do that with TV. I don't know why I still pay for cable. You know why? Because it was one of those package deals. But now I've gone through long enough where I could call up. It's the other half. I have to call like another company to cancel. But then the internet and the cable are a package, but they're separate. But they get billed together so they can like crank up the bill. Anyway, it's all a bunch of crap. So speaking of like a bunch of crap, what are the new things that they're going to come out with after they kill off all the unwanted people? Because you think that they're like, oh, we need a reset. And we're not going to need all this stuff because there's not going to be a lot of people around. And when the people that are left after all of the horrible things that we produce and make happen, like the wars, they get away with it and all that, then, you know, we're going to have new technologies and new ways of doing things, right? New ways of bringing people into the fold and putting them under the grid. Some things might be actually kind of cool. And if it was an honorable world, maybe they would be cool. Like flexible batteries. They got wearable technologies for healthcare and e-textiles. And this is from the World Economic Forum themselves. They talk about flexible batteries. Several types are currently available. These batteries are rechargeable and include lithium ion or zinc carbon systems placed on conductive polymer current conductors. In some cases, additives enhance conductivity and flexibility. The electrodes of flexible batteries can be coated with or even printed onto flexible substrates, including carbon-based materials like graphene, carbon fibers, or cloth. Yeah, now speaking of graphene, you know, all those shots they put in people that are like they've got the graphene building stuff. I mean, I don't know. Has there been any update? I remember when people were seeing like crazy stuff, like the circuits being built. It's been a little while. Have we double checked? Have we got more microscopic readings from microscopes and blood tests? I mean, remember they were pulling the clots out. Now a lot of people, this has had enough time to mesh with the system, the RNA, right, the DNA, and maybe some of these people have had offspring. And they have, right? With a sort of, it's born into, it's in the DNA, right? Like, it's kind of a supercharged method of what they've done this with insects. And not on the DNA level. What they've done is they've, on the pupa stage, when the insect is like a larva, when it's a larva or a pupa, I think a pupa, and then it goes into full-on insect, adult, right? So in the pupa stage, they put these little microchips in whatever insect they're working with. And then it sort of meshes with the body. And then it grows into adult. And now this microchip is embedded. And so they can do that on the, I'm going to say the nanoscale, nanophysics. It's very interesting. Last week, I think I played a thing about a guy who was talking about nanophysics, or maybe that was on Monday. I think it might have been on Monday. So anyway, nanophysics is where they can just change a few properties and the entire molecular process, and you can do anything because now you're working at the nano level. Interesting things happen when you combine different things that are not natural. Like, let's say, wood and gold, where you're combining. And they're doing that with some of the injections where they've got, you know, what was it, magnesium or silicon and aluminum and carbon and these things, making these new materials that don't go together, things that are made out of constructed material. But they could do it in a positive way. Well, odds are they wouldn't. They'll tell you they are, but, you know, like, oh, it's for healthcare. We're going to cure cancer and make blind people see. Well, they could do that. It's absolutely possible, but that's probably not going to be the first thing. They might do some sort of token thing. Like, oh, look, everybody, the altruistic things we could do. Now, unfortunately, we can't cure everybody of everything all the time, even though they could. But, you know, look how wonderful we are. We're trying. It's just like those people that give money to help, like, the homeless, like in big cities, and they make like $250,000 a year. And, well, if they were actually helped the homeless and came up with solutions at work, they wouldn't need them anymore because there wouldn't be any homeless. So it's not an incentive. It's a circle. It's not an incentive to you know, fix the problem because, well, then there won't be a need for the people that are fixing the problem to fix it. Yeah, but people are too simple to see things through and ahead and go 2 plus 2? Yeah, okay, 2 plus 2. Yeah, but you didn't get the answer yet. Well, it doesn't matter. We know that the question is, we know what the, all right. Yeah, so flexible batteries, you're going to use them in wearable medical devices, biomedical sensors. Oh, so they could make trees that you could pick Apple iPhones off of. That was the guy talking about. They could grow technology. We could transform the world. We really could. Part of the problem is we've got psychotics in charge, and the way they want to transform it is not entirely beneficial. And the other part of the problem is us. We're psychotic too, many of us. We're just, I mean, have you seen the public lately? Oh my goodness. What are we going to do with the public? What are we going to do? I mean, we've got the psychos in charge that are trying to kill off most of them, all of us maybe. But not all of us should die, I don't think. I think some of us should survive. The smart ones. Well, just don't take that shot, okay? Anyway, they're going to try to make you take it again. What else? What other things? Generative artificial intelligence, that's something to look at. Do you know what we could do with AI and giving us new ideas? And then generative AI. And then you have artificial general intelligence. That's the one I meant. AGI. But the generative AI is a powerful type of AI that can create new and original content by learning, let's say, patterns in data or using complex algorithms and methods and learning inspired by the human brain. It's currently focused on producing text and programming images and sound, but this technology could be applied to a wide range of purposes, including things like drug design and architecture and engineering. In fact, NVIDIA already has this sort of, I forget what they call it, this thing, this sort of infrastructure where they're going to combine the AIs and have them produce new things, you know, like a brand new automobile or run the scheduling for the guys that fix the phones or the computers or whatnot. So humans don't have to do that. And we could make a really wonderful paradise world. AI could transform it. I mean, there is nothing. There's no rule. There's no law. There's no even. Now, some people may disagree, but we don't have to work to better our lives. We don't have to work in the sense of what we do now. Sure, we can't just sit around and go home, but we could enhance our environment to the point where we could better ourselves in more intellectual, less strenuously labor-intensive ways. We could put more of our population into the eclectic range of art and philosophy and higher intellectual discourse and things, you know, because we could get to a point where we could let the machines take care of the menial tasks. But part of it, like anything else, requires temperament, temperance, and reason, logic, and honor. Because, of course, there's probably going to be somewhere out there that wants to gain, right? You got to give me a little bit extra. Give me something. And there might even be the malicious. And that's the problem with our society, right? Not everybody is honorable, especially at the higher levels. Although they'll surround themselves with altruistic titles, deeds. Oh, look at all of the wonderful things that my foundation is doing. Bill Gates is trying to save you. Everybody knows it's a bunch of shit. It's a bunch of everybody knows. These things that you're not supposed to talk about.
the politically incorrect, the emperor that has no clothes, till somebody comes along and says, look, the dude is naked. Don't say that. Don't say that he's naked. So, yeah, I mean, AI, high school, university students, they're going to use generative AI, and now already are. Some institutions forbid the use, but others are integrating generative models into teaching practices or even training students to master these tools. Used properly, generative AI can create personalized curricula that adjust to student skills and learning progress while encouraging critical thinking, igniting creativity, and harnessing novel ideas. I absolutely agree with that. It can. But, you know, I mean, people need to learn how to use weapons like fire or firearms and use properly. They can be beneficial. Fire used properly can be very beneficial. Fire is good. But if you just willy-nilly use it, like I'm just going to put some fire over here on the side and put it on the paper there. You know, it's going to get away from you. You got to keep an eye on the fire. You got to build a wall around it and make sure, you know, that's that fire box, that big heat thing that they put in your food area. I think you call it a kitchen. You know, when you make fire inside and it makes the, what is it? An oven.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. Harnessing dangerous technologies. Electricity. Maybe you don't use direct fire in your firebox. Maybe it heats up an element. It gets really, really hot. And all you got to do is open it up and like sit there or touch it or just let it go off. And it can really mess up your day. But somehow most people figure out how to use that and deal with it. And every once in a while, there's a screw up and things happen. But, you know, nobody's perfect. And that's just, it is what it is. So it's the same thing, I think, with with AI. You know, we all have a AI-powered Android in our house. Every once in a while, one just goes off the deep end and murders the entire family. But, you know, we deal with it. It is what it is. I know. I know. Nothing's perfect. I don't have the answers. I'm just saying. Sustainable aviation fuel. What's this one? Moving the aviation industry towards net zero. I think that's a bunch of hooey. Okay, we need to forget about this crap. Did you hear there's this kid? I don't know. He was 12 years old. And he died of a heart attack during PE. And they said it was the weather. I'm sorry. I'm not disrespecting or laughing at the death of a child. I take the laughter back. I don't mean it that way. I'm laughing at the absurdity of everybody blaming it on the weather. It was hot. And then they went on with a little explanation about how, you know, kids have a lot of reserve energy, but every once in a while they use it all up and then it just out of the blue. I laugh at your explanation. And nobody, everybody knows, but no, we can't stop. Don't say it. Don't even hint. It was too hot. I tell you, it was the weather. And then it was the teacher or the principal or whoever the hell it was. I think it was the principal of the school was saying stuff like, you know, this has got to be a setup, propaganda piece. Because he's like, yeah, we've got to find a way to combat the weather or something ridiculous like that. So these things don't happen. We've got to address this problem or else more children are going to die. I mean, we got to make it cooler or warmer or whatever the hell they want to do today. We've got to tame the weather so that more of your children don't die. You do believe us, right? It's the weather, right? Okay, don't say it's not the weather because we're going to ban you if you do. And then call you names and everybody will look at you funny and you'll be like a conspiracy theorist thinking it's some other thing like, I don't know, chemicals. Like, you don't even know what's in it. Exactly. I don't even know what's in it. Do you? Did you really? You know what's in it. And we're going to see who the really stupid people are this next round. I'm kind of like looking forward to it. Yeah, let's bring it on. You and everybody wear masks. Yeah, these people are going to run around trying to make people put masks on again. I saw somebody wearing one in a in a car already. I don't know if they've been wearing it. They've probably been wearing it the whole time. I don't know. If somebody asks me to wear a mask, I don't know if I'm going to laugh at. I'll probably laugh at him while I slap them. Yeah, you can follow me around while I wear a mask, right? Yeah. I'm going to wear a guy, but y'all, I'll be right back with my mask. And I'll go home and I'll get my Guy Fawkes mask. And I'll come in and I'll fill my cart with like, and I'll just walk out the door. Yeah, we got a contingency. I'm going to go out the back door, though. I'm already planning on being a menace to society when everything breaks down. Yeah. I'm all out of a metaverse for mental health. Surgeon General for the United States recently declared war, another war, on what he calls one of the country's most pressing public health issues of our time. What is that? Excess screen time and social media can decrease psychological well-being, but they can also enhance well-being when used responsibly. Screen time spent building connections in shared virtual spaces might help combat the growing mental health crisis as opposed to contributing to it. So they want to stick you in a little virtual sailboat or a virtual canoe with your therapist, or maybe it'll be an AI girlfriend. I saw this. They got AI girlfriends now. Well, would you like me to be a friend or a girlfriend? Let's see. Let me click. Would you like me to be romantic or whatever? Virtual shared spaces. Yeah. People can interact professionally and socially. The future of these spaces is commonly referred to as the metaverse. Well, here's what's going to happen. If we don't address the physical verse, your physical verse is going to be shit, right? There's going to be like fentanyl zombies running around. There's going to be trash. Everything's going to be run down, garbage everywhere, crap. And it's just going to be a very depressing, bleak place. And you're going to be like, oh, let me put on my virtual reality goggles. Oh, it's so nice. Everything is clean and bright and cheerful and people look wonderful and my avatar is hot. Yeah, everything. And so you're going to be like, I don't want to leave this place. It's too nice. Because if I take my helmet off, if I take my goggles off, I'm back in the freaking shithole. So let me keep my goggles on. And you'll see, like, right now, you got these zombies that are bent over at the waist walking around the cities on fentanyl. Next you'll see, they'll just be sitting there in corners with VR goggles on. And they'll have some sort of digital drug. You know, like some wire will be, jacked right into them, and they'll just go, I was researching fentanyl just because I'm like, what would drive a person to be like that? I see all these people, like in the videos, I see them bent over, and they're just like, they're always fiddling with something and bent over and like out of it. And so I decided, just for the fun of it, to see what people like are on it. Like, so apparently it doesn't even get you, quote, high. You know? No, it gets you high, but not high. Like, it doesn't have the euphoria. So then I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. Doesn't even have the euphoria? Well, and I guess, so all it really, the guy, it was saying it's mainly for people that have done so much other stuff like heroin and opiates that their tolerance is so high that they can't get quote unquote high anymore. They're just doing to try to remain normal so their addiction, they don't get sick. And the fentanyl is cheap and it does that. It's like an extremely cheap, what is that other one? Methadone. However, what it also does, hello kitty, it also gives you sort of a blackout. So you don't know what happened. You just like, you do it, you bend over, and you wake up in the future. It's like 7 hours, 10 hours, go boom. And you don't remember anything. And then you want more. And like, whoa, that's just, no. And people that are on it, they're like, no, it's a hell cycle. They're like, I need to get off it. I would love to get off it, but
their tolerance is so high in their addiction, and it grips you apparently so horrible that, yeah, I mean, you see these people out on the streets. So, what else are they talking about here? Mental health crisis that existed prior to COVID has increased at unprecedented levels. Gaming platforms are already being leveraged for mental health treatment. I'll feed you in a moment. Let's see. Deep Well Therapeutics have created video games to treat depression and anxiety. So that's something that maybe could be looked at, right? I mean, a technology that might help people that are depressed or something. Again, temperament. We don't want to like just stick everybody in the metaverse and forget about the physical verse. But somebody that might have schizophrenia, somebody that might have depression or something, an elderly lady that's lonely, maybe these could increase the quality of life for in extreme cases. Just like augmentation for the blind. If you can go in there with nanotechnology and fix somebody so they can see, I don't see anything wrong with that. You know, now then there's the jumping the shark going past the line. I said, well, what about augmentation so now I can see at night and in the ultraviolet? Well, now you're going past the natural ability of humans. So maybe we should draw the line there. You don't get to make a bionic man, Steve Austin. And Jamie Summers, that was her name. Steve Austin and Jamie Summers, the bionic man and the bionic woman. We can rebuild him, the $6 million man and the bionic woman. Yeah. You can't make them stronger, okay? Can't make super soldiers, but you can help a person see, you can help a person hear, you can cure cancer. Anything that would, let's say, stabilize the body to normal baseline. How about that for a standpoint? That as if we can get the body to baseline normalcy, nominal, that's what we strive for. If somebody's starting to fall and they're like, oh, I can't walk, I can't see, I'm getting these diseases, well, we could remove those negative factors and bring them back up to a stable baseline like everybody else. Because we know what that is. Just like we used to know what a woman was. They changed the definition. That's why nobody can say. And like the older dictionaries and medical dictionaries and things, they had the definition. Here it is, plain black and white. Like in 2020 or whatever. They're, oh, no. Anyway, so, well, that's what it says. Oh, shut the hell up. You stupid idiots. Wearing plant sensors. Yeah, really. Traditionally, crops have been monitored. Yeah, they're using AI for crops. They've got this robot machine that has all these little sensors, and it goes and it can see every little weed compared to the sprouts, and it zaps with lasers the weeds really fast when it rolls over. So what you get is a very good crop of food. You know, one of the things I thought about is the elite are not worried about destroying anything because they've got all the answers set up. As soon as they need to destroy it, they're like, we need people to starve to death and burn down all the infrastructure because we don't need trains anymore. I mean, we're not going to release that good stuff yet. But as soon as you all die and everything is burned up or shot to hell, then we can come with our 3D robot, you know, building technology and build everything real quick. Be like 1 year and everything will be like, well, futuristic cities. So what? What are you worried about? Oh, you're slated for death. That's right, because you're just a serf. So if people figure that out and they go, wait a minute, you've got everything ready and you're just hiding it until we all die. Is that the plan? Yeah, that's the plan. Maybe we should go and find out where they're hiding that stuff. Who's hiding? What? What are they hiding? Who's hiding? Yeah, they're hiding the stuff. What's spatial omics? The human body is composed of approximately 37.2 trillion cells. Did they count them? How they all work together and keep us alive and healthy? Well, spatiomics will provide researchers with an answer. By combining advanced imaging techniques with the specificity and resolution of DNA sequencing, this emerging method enables the mapping of the what, where, and when of biological processes at the molecular level. So we're there, starting with an organ of interest such as a mouse brain. Scientists slice tissue into sections only one cell thick. Innovative techniques are then used to visualize the locations of specific biomolecules in each slice. Spatial omics allows previously unobservable cell architecture and biological events to be viewed in unprecedented detail. So, yes, they can cure cancer. Yes, they can make you well again. They could probably, in my opinion, they could probably expand the lifespan. And that might, they might even be able to do more than that. Like, you know, dare I even say it, brain transplants? Can you imagine? You're like, okay, George Soros, we're going to do it now. Everybody's going to, you're going to be declared dead. But actually what we're going to do is we're going to take your brain out and we're going to put it in a new body. And then he's like, oh, I like this body. He's like a catalog in front of him. He's like, okay. And so what'll happen is then they fake his death or whatever. And then they, come here. And then they pop his brain out. But it'd be like, is that a brain transplant? Is a body transplant? Like, or the head? Well, you wouldn't do the head. You just do the brain. Right? So it's still you in a new body. Would you do it? And they're like, now this body is, put your brain in when the body is like, the head is a, like, it grows too, right? I mean, so let's say of an 18-year-old, and bloop, and they put that, now you're 18-year-old Alex or something, Soros. Now he has already got a son. Oh, it's your brother. But it's really your father. Yes, I'm going to be around for another 80 years, son, keeping my eye on you. Hey, I wouldn't put it past it. If I was one of those crazy mad scientists with billions of dollars, I'd probably bring it up. Yeah, hey, have you tried it? Have we? Remember the Gilligan's Island? Where they were like, oh, let's. Well, that was a machine. Where it took the consciousness of like the movie star and put it in the skipper. Everybody was somebody else. Yeah, no, it was Marianne was the skipper and the movie star was anyway. So. And then you just play that person like, oh, the queen died, but now she's like somebody you don't know. She's like, and then she's going to be a movie star. Maybe it's something weird like that. What do you think? That'd be an interesting, as a practical look, to give you a Fetterman brain. You're like, well, I support clone brains. Clone brains, I support clone brains. Yes. That was my Fetterman imitation. Oh, what else we got? Flexible neuroelectronics. So that's the brain machine interfaces, BMIs. That's, you know, cognitive enhancements, neuroprosthetics. Okay. There's, maybe somebody can't walk. She put in a neuroprosthetic so that they can now use electrodes to interface with the nervous system to make them walk. Is that bad? No, I think that's good. What do you think? Helping somebody that's crippled or maybe they have MS. Their quality of life sucks. They're on a machine. They got to move their wheelchair with their mouth because they can't move anything else. Do you think if you could put a little thing inside and cure them so that they could be normal like you, would you be against that and say, oh, no, that's it's not natural? But at the same time, maybe you put in a little booster and then now they can jump five times as much as you and their intelligence is three times as much. All right, now you've gone past baseline. We know what baseline is. Humans are not going to abide by that because the simple fact is we're not honorable. But we got to live with that. We're going to have drunk drivers. We're going to have people that go out and kill each other. But, hey, you know, we're just going to have to live. Our own elite are trying to kill us. Look at, our role. Because there's supposed to be examples and role models, right? Anyway, everybody's at war. We're on the verge of war. Everybody's calling everybody names and all this. It's like, come on. And we're supposed to be, like, law-abiding citizens. Well, the world's going to shit. Yeah, everything's inverted on your earth. But you're supposed to be the honorable one. No. Maybe that's part of the test. We are supposed to be honorable, even in the face of all of this. It's testing us. It's testing your resolve and your honor, too. And, you know, be honorable amongst yourselves and your fellow man, because it is the golden rule to treat others as you would be treated or you would like to be treated. But when they screw up, F around and find out, give them both barrels, man. No quarter. If they disrespect you and come in your space, you both barrels, go home, ask questions later. I mean, well, okay. Flexible neuro implants and sustainable computing, of course. Sustainable computing. My chair, it's too squeaky. What else do we have? I'm looking at now AI-facilitated healthcare. I guess that could be a good thing or a very bad thing. See, the thing is, we need an ethical AI. We need an AI that has feelings, don't we? So they can go, oh, and empathize like a human can and say, look, hopefully most humans, hopefully the good in us outweighs the bad, and we'll train the AI on it. And it'll be like another human. Maybe the AI, now it won't have honor either. I can hope. Hope, there's that word again. Could we make an honorable AI? There's the question. You know, humanity has been dangerously tinkering with its reality. And reality is a dangerous place. But does that mean we should stop? Do we even know if, when, and where to stop? No. And even if we said yes, we're not all going to agree to that. Absolutely not. All right. So what I've got next is, we're going to go ahead and take a quick little break, and then we'll come back and I'm going to run for you. Actually, you know what? I don't think we will take a break. Because this is going to run about 58 minutes, and so if you want to hear the whole thing, I guess I should go ahead and start playing it within the next minute or two. So let me wrap up on everything else I was going to say. There's been a coup, another coup, of course, in Gabon, and they're all happy about it. There's a guy, Mark Schmitz, whose son was killed in Kabul. Actually, you know what? You should hear this. I'm going to go ahead and play this for you. This, he was addressing Joe Biden. Joe Biden, is he directly? He's in the room looking at Joe Biden saying this. Here we go. Let me get it ready here if it'll run. Okay, doesn't want to run there. Let's try it this way. Click. There we go. All right, this is Mark Schmitz. His son was killed in Kabul during the Biden-Afghanistan withdrawal.
Not a single person has been held accountable. Our so-called leader can't seem to even utter their names in public, not even once. Mr. Biden has run his entire political campaign for 50 years as the family man. Well, I've got news for you, sir. The curtain has been lifting, and that campaign slogan will never work again. We have seen what's going on in your family. And even worse, we've seen how you've been treating us as Gold Star families. And there couldn't be anything more disgusting and cowardly than the way you have treated us. You are a disgrace to this nation. You have no business having ultimate command over our military. And I regret not saying that to your face when I had the opportunity in Dover. I felt it more important to bite my tongue. But I also had more important things on my mind at that time, like receiving my son's lifeless body stateside. Well, I stood there on the tarmac watching you check your watch over and over again. All I wanted to do was shout out, it's 2:30, asshole. But out of respect to the other grieving families, I bit my tongue once again. Well, as you could probably tell by now, I'm done biting my tongue. You, sir, stole their lives, their futures, their dreams, and have ripped apart 13 families. You cannot even man up and admit that. You, sir, gave us all the title Gold Star Family. You, sir, discredit honor and integrity. 2 years later, there are things I find myself thinking about. Where and what was Biden's logic sneaking out of Bagram in the middle of the night before ever getting a single Afghan partner or American civilian out? This is the purest definition of intentional negligence. This is just one of many irresponsible and negligent decisions coming from the White House. In addition, leaving behind billions of dollars of our finest military hardware has led to the biggest international free black market free market in history. Unfortunately, this will undoubtedly lead to more American military lives lost in the future. Between what has been happening here domestically, for example, the border, over the last 2.5 years, and all your failed foreign policy decisions, I would venture a guess that you have more American blood on your hands, Mr. Biden, than any president in U.S. history.
Well, there you go. You know, people are not holding their tongues any longer. Yeah. Anyway, one more comment I wanted to make, and I've noticed, you know, since California out here has dropped their felony conviction price to below $950 or whatnot, and we've had, you know, a sort of uptick, I guess you could say, in looting, people going into stores and helping themselves, and it's now in mass. Now it's become a trend. It's spiraled into, before it was just people would go in, take some shit, maybe mess some stuff up and run away and leave. Now, and it was maybe an individual. Now it's masses, like mobs, like they use social media, like let's say even maybe a high school group or whatever. And then 100 people come in, take shit, mess stuff up. And now it's over $950. And now they're assaulting. There's one person sprayed pepper spray, another person's been smacked, and, you know, there's property damage involved. So I fail to see how it's any different now. I mean, I guess it's just not nobody's prosecuting. So the as far as the eligibility to be prosecuted, well, we're talking now about strong-arm robbery, grand larceny, assault, battery. So it's no longer like, well, it's under $950 and there was no victim. Yeah, people are getting the shit beat out of them and their stuff taken. And people are now sort of getting one step braver. You know how like you have like a pack of wolves or something will start nipping at an animal and then they'll get a little closer and a little closer. And then they get a little braver and a little braver. Same with kids. Maybe they're doing something and, you know, messing around. And at first they're a little timid. And then the crowd mentality gets a little braver and a little braver. Well, that's escalating. And now people are getting a little more attitude, myself included, finding myself going, why should I stand in line when everybody else is doing it? And I know that's not exactly the right attitude, but I'm just saying it is what it is. Be wary. Keep your wits about you, have some mindfulness, and you know, keep your head on a swivel. And when you're out in public now, because anything can kick off at any time. It used to only happen in the prison yard, but apparently now it can happen in any place. All right, I'm going to shut up now because I've already rambled a little bit too long. This is a conversation about the battle for your brain with everybody's favorite professor. No, not Yuval Noah Harari. It's the female version. It's Professor Nita Farahani. Take it away, Nita.
All right, welcome everyone. We'll wait a second as everyone joins the room, and then we'll get started.
Go past a little bit here.
Welcome everyone. We are here to talk about this amazing new book, The Battle for Your Brain. My name is Francis Shen. I'm a faculty member at the Harvard Medical School Center for Bioethics, Harvard University affiliated professor at Harvard Law School, and faculty member at the Center for Law, Brain, and Behavior at MGH. In a moment, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Carmel Shachar, who will introduce Professor Farahani. But before I do that, a few housekeeping items. First, thank you to the Petrie Flom Center and the HMS Center for Bioethics for co-sponsoring this event, and to staff at both centers for getting the word out and supporting it. Second, this event is being recorded, so if you like what you see, you'll be able to pass it on to your friends afterwards. We'll share the link with everyone who's attending. Third, we invite you to submit your questions for Dr. Farahani. There is a Q&A button that you will see in your Zoom webinar screen. You click that, and you can submit a question. Given time, we won't be able to get to all of them, but we will certainly be able to get to some of them. So those are my housekeeping notes. And with that, let me introduce Carmel Shachar, who is currently the executive director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy Biotechnology and bioethics at Harvard Law School, and she will soon be taking on the new role of Assistant Clinical Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Health Law and Policy Clinic at Harvard Law School. Congratulations on that new role. Thanks for being here. Thanks for Petrie Flom co-sponsorship, and let me hand it over to you.
Thanks, Francis. I am really delighted to have the privilege to introduce Professor Nita Farahani. She is the Robinson O. Everett Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at Duke Law School, as well as the founding director of Duke Science and Society, the faculty chair of the Duke MA in Bioethics and Science Policy, and the principal investigator of SLAP Lab, which is quite possibly the best acronym. We are very privileged at the Petrie Flom Center to work with Nita because she is also co-editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Journal of Law and the Biosciences, in addition to many other groups that she contributes her time, including being on the board of advisors for Scientific American. Nita is somebody who I find really admirable as a bioethicist and a health lawyer. I will say one short story and then move on so that you can actually hear from her. We were lucky enough to co-edit a volume on consumer genetic technology with Nita several years ago. And at the writer's dinner for the conference that led into the book, we were all discussing consumer genetic technologies such as 23andMe, but we were all discussing it in a very bloodless way. Like, oh, somebody could use 23andMe, but not I. I, of course, as a bioethicist, am a robot with no DNA, and I'm not interested in it at all. And Nita, I think, was the first person from the group to really talk about it as, do I want to do this? And actually, this is amazing that we can peer into our DNA, and this is a really great thing. And I think her just discussing it in such a lovely, candid, and open way shifted the conversation and made me comfortable saying, yeah, I actually have used 23andMe, and it taught me some really valuable things about my genetics that I'm really happy for. And so when I heard that Nita was writing a book on ethics and neuroscience, I got very excited as a bioethicist married to a neuroscientist, because as I've told her, I now have an easy gift for our wedding anniversary coming up. But I think even if I was not married to a neuroscientist, this book would be one of my top choices for my summer reading. I think this conversation is going to be fantastic. And Francis, thank you for pulling this event together. And Nita, thank you for giving us your time.
Thanks for those lovely comments. Carmel, it's such a delight to join you guys today.
Yeah, this is wonderful. Thanks, Carmel. So I'm going to get us started. First of all, I encourage everyone to read the book. I echo everything Carmel said, whether it's summer reading or anniversary presents or four-year student. It's a really wonderful book. I was telling Professor Farahani before we got on, I was really struck by how personal the book is. If you read it, you'll learn of Nita's family, her children, her mother, conversations with her father about her mother's health, about Professor Farahani's own brain challenges and how she's tackled them. So thank you for writing a book that is both intellectual and intimate. The core thesis of the book, at least as I take it, is that we're at this crossroads with neurotechnology. There's one version of the future that's really awesome. There's another version that's really bad, and we have some tough choices to make. And the core, I think, of the emphasis in the book is that one of the things we need to do is protect legal protections for our cognitive liberty at the individual level. So I'd like to ask you maybe to help us and our audience think about some context for this argument and for the book. You know, and as Carmel suggested, you've got talent across like all these different areas. You know so much. When you sat down and kind of thought about what you're going to write about, and with so many different options and so many ways that neuroscience is affecting society, how did you come to the decision to write this book at this time?
Oh, that's a big question, Francis. So first, you know, I would say it seems like the book is well-timed in the moment that people are incredibly anxious about what's happening with AI. And the book is in part that, right? It's in part a book about the extraordinary advances in AI that now enable the decoding of the human brain as well. But that's luck in having published the book in the moment at which a lot of people are anxious about it already. I've been thinking about these issues for a very long time, right? More than a decade. I've been writing about the different ways in which neuroscience and neurotechnology are used in the legal system and give us a lens by which we can understand some of our pre-existing commitments within law. But in each of those earlier endeavors, what I discovered was that there was really kind of a missing hole. There was a way in which we haven't been thinking about the ability to actually peer into, manipulate, change the human brain much more directly than we can otherwise. And in recognizing that hole, I started writing early on about the role of cognitive liberty in our lives. And by cognitive liberty, I really mean the right to self-determination over our brains and mental experiences as a right to both access and use technologies, but also a right from interference with our mental privacy and freedom of thought. And this book was, for me, very much an exploration of the emerging technologies that enable that access and decoding, the ways in which that will become widespread and are already becoming widespread, and fleshing out the legal and normative case for cognitive liberty. And the process of writing the book was my own journey, and that's a lot of the reasons why there's so much personal in the book. It was my personal journey in both understanding and grappling with these technologies, but also in developing this bigger framework of cognitive liberty. And so it just came very naturally to inject myself in it because I was part of the story, right? Whether it was, you know, watching a movie with my daughter and, you know, and puzzling over like, oh my gosh, that parallel between the science fiction and the realities, and just writing about that experience to help people kind of get entrance into it. And I'll say this, which is, to me, it's a very natural evolution of technology, which is people are very accustomed to sensors and their smartwatches and in their rings that track their heartbeats and footsteps and breaths and body temperatures. And so the idea that brain sensors can now detect and decode our brain activity is a natural progression of where technology and the quantified self movement is. But it was only when I started to hear from technologists themselves about moving from, you know, what had been a category of technology that had really been niche products with very limited applications to embedding brain sensors into our everyday devices like earbuds and headphones and watches and wearable tattoos, and how that not only will decode and give us access to our brain activity, but enable us to have a new way of interfacing with technology, that I really understood how urgent the conversation was, that this was about to be a transformational technology. And unlike AI, where everybody is talking about it, nobody seems to be talking about this transformational technology that's happening. So that made it incredibly urgent for me to then finally, with all of these ideas percolating for a very long time, to write this book and to define this category of cognitive liberty in law and in our lives. I am not hearing you.
I pressed the wrong button. That was right, me. Good. No, that was great. And leads to a couple more questions. So I think a lot of the, you know, at least some of the attendees today are people who work or might want to work in this area, thinking about, you know, how do you anticipate the future and then account for it. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. You mentioned the word urgency, and that certainly comes across in the book. And you mentioned in and through some stories illustrated how, at least my sense was that you thought this might happen, then you see a certain presentation or you have a couple conversations and you walk away thinking this is actually happening already now. But how do you, as someone who is working on things that haven't happened yet, how do you get the timing right? That is, you definitely don't want to wait till it's too late. On the other hand, I think of, you know, the year 2000 hullabaloo, where we got all ready for this thing that never happened, right? It was always the next big thing. It didn't happen. So how do you do that? Like, get ready for something, and in particular, think about making laws for a world that sort of exists, but doesn't quite yet exist.
So a lot of us have read Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And I think it's a tremendous book. And it's also a tremendous book about a phenomena that has already happened, right, which is that our personal data has already been commodified. We have become the product for companies. The business model has been built around the commodification of data and the misuse in many cases of data. And that doesn't have to be the story with neurotechnology, right? It can be a different story that we can write. But you can't write that story decades in advance. And there isn't the political will or the interest in writing it decades in advance. But there is a moment to get it right. And that's, I believe, this moment. And here's why. So first, you've read the book, Francis, so you know very little of what I've described is about a future, right? A lot of what I'm describing is about what's already here and what is already happening, just not at widespread scale across society, right? But I mean, 5,000 companies worldwide are already using smart cap technology to track employees' fatigue levels. You know, I gave a presentation at the World Economic Forum in Davos about the use of brain wearables in the workplace. And a major global corporation CEO came up to me afterwards and said, that was such an interesting presentation. You can include us as a use case because we've already used the technology that you're describing on thousands of employees. And, you know, we have some really interesting data that we'd love to share with you about all of the other metrics that we're measuring beyond attention and fatigue, including, you know, engagement and boredom and, you know, a bunch of other aspects in the workplace. When I talk with the technologists in the space, and I did a tremendous number of interviews in the book with both the technologists, but also the deep dives into the, you know, scientists and researchers in it, they all think we're at the tipping point, right? None of them think like this is technology that's decades away. Now, some of the applications are decades away, meaning, or not even decades away, but, you know, a decade away. Like right now, EEG isn't fast enough to be a very reliable controller for interface with other technology. There's a latency in how quickly you can turn on and off or use it in the place of a mouse, for example. And so the way that, you know, brain sensors will first become widespread is really to track everyday brain activity from focus and attention to everyday metrics of brain health. As an interface for all of the rest of our technology, those are applications that will come in time. But in kind of getting the moment right, I think getting the moment right for something that is as transformational as neurotechnology, that is as transformational as direct access to be able to alter and detect what's happening in the brain, the moment before is the right time to get the safeguards into place, especially if they're the kinds of safeguards that I'm talking about, which is to have the terms of service be fundamentally different. Commodification of brain data has already begun. It isn't at scale yet. Brain sensors are already being sold worldwide. It isn't everybody who's using them yet. When it becomes an everyday part of our everyday lives, that's the moment at which you hope that the safeguards are already in place. And so that's why I think now is the right moment to do so. But you have to do a lot of futurism. You can't be writing about, you know, science fiction decades in advance. If you're writing a book like this, I think what most people have said about the book that they found startling is not that I am writing about a future, but that I am writing about so many real world examples that are already in use today. And that's, I think, what motivates people to recognize the urgency of the conversation.
Yeah, there are lots of these real world examples. And it leads to where I want to go next, which is that throughout the book, you really, and I commend you for this, you take a balanced approach that is, at least some of the headlines covering your book, I think, have picked up on the need to protect the brain. Bad things are going to happen. We need to go back to be yeoman. It's not your argument at all, as I'm going to point out, but we need to be yeoman farmers and like an anti-technology movement. You're actually, and you come out, we'll get to this later, you think traditionalists are on the wrong side of history with respect to sort of paternalism. But even at the end, you write, with neurotechnology, it's not too late to protect against the same fate for our brains. We stand at a fork in the road, where the coming dawn of neurotechnology could change our lives for the better or lead to this dystopian future. But I want to focus on that better part, because I feel like, especially in, say, the bioethics, neuroethics community, you get more credit for finding all the bad things that are going to happen and then trying to stop them. But one bad thing is that people couldn't see the benefits here and don't uptake the technology. In fact, it could lead to inequities that those who can afford and understand this stuff start using it, and those don't. And there'd be fear for using it, right? Sort of see vaccines as a place where, boy, it would have been really good if more had used them. Could you help us paint a picture of what the better future looks like? If we get it right, if we, you know, get the laws in place, what does flourishing look like alongside this neurotech that's already here?
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, Francis. So first I will say, it's hard to write a book in this space that really is balanced. And I really believe there's a lot of good here and there's some really frightening aspects of it. And it is about getting it right. And Even working with my editor, this was one of the hardest parts. He was like, nuance is not something that is easy to get across. And this kind of nuanced position of like, it's good, it's bad, it's both, like that. He's like, that is not, it's much easier to sell a book that is like, look at the dystopian future that's coming. And some of the headlines have done that. And that's been a little frustrating for me, to be honest, is when, you know, you have these super dystopian clickbait headlines, especially when I'm writing about clickbait as a bad thing in the book, right? So, you know, that's unfortunate. Some of the most well-written pieces that I've really treasured have been the ones that have done the nuance. And those, I think, have advanced the conversation in really meaningful ways. There was a Guardian piece that I thought was phenomenal in this regard that really set and reset the tone of the conversation that had already started around the book. But on the positive, so why do I take that approach? So first, you know, cognitive liberty, as I define it in the book, is again, the right to and the right from. And the right to, as I see it, is a powerful right to self-determination over our brains and mental experiences, which includes the right to access what's happening in our own brains and the right to change it, whether that's to enhance it or diminish it. And let's just start with access, because that's where some really positive things could occur. We know and track virtually nothing that's happening in our own brains right now, which is really stunning if you think about it by comparison to like tracking our heartbeats and our footsteps. And, you know, people can tell you their cholesterol levels, their blood pressure, but they only have their internal software to access what's happening in their own brains, even though most of us identify our sense of self most closely with our own brains. And so from the basics, like little things, which are big things for many of us, like, when do you focus the best? Do you focus best in the morning? Do you focus best in the afternoon? Do you really work better from home? What is the switching cost for you between going from platform to platform when you're on social media and then you go back into writing? How much time does that actually cost you? What does the, you know, kind of arc of cognitive decline look like over time? If you're an epileptic, can you detect epileptic seizures minutes to up to an hour before they occur? You know, tracking basic brain metrics from everything from your focus and attention and boredom and fatigue to your biases, like actually being able to detect your own biases and see not just through implicit association tests, but through actual targeting of an identification of your own biases. Like there's a lot we can learn through the process of self-discovery about ourselves, about our brains, about our brain health. There's a lot we can do to enhance and to even ease our own suffering. And I talk about some very personal experiences of using, for example, neurofeedback in my own life, drugs and devices that I've used, and, you know, my own journey of chronic migraines and trying absolutely everything under the sun within the realm of neurotechnology to do so. So, it's very scary to make your brain transparent to others. There are very significant downsides to doing so. But the reason we're going to go into this new era isn't, you know, just so that governments and corporations can hack into our brains. The reason we're going to go into this new era is because it can be transformational for our health, for our well-being, and even what it means to be human. I mean, brain-to-brain communication, brain-to-text communication, there's so much that may happen in this coming age with neurotechnology that will transform humanity in many ways that will be positive, that I think we'll willingly go into this era. And I want us, if we do so, to do so recognizing how to do so in ways that will be beneficial rather than, you know, harmful to society.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And I'm glad that it's interesting to hear that you had that conversation with your editor, because it did come through that you do see this balance. I understand, you know, you got to sell the book and it's got to be positioned a certain way. But I commend you for doing that balancing. I want to contrast the benefits version with the harms version, the sort of dystopia that you also raise, with one line of thread that I didn't see discussed as much in the book. And that has to do with the intersection with race and scientific racism and racial inequity. And as context for this, there's been a group here at Harvard that's started to focus on neurotechnology justice. And it's been a lot of fun. And we had some support from the Dana Foundation to do a neurotechnology justice summit in February. And we asked the audience, and actually we had 8 Dana fellows, amazing people. We asked them to basically the fork in the road question that you ask: is neurotechnology going to be co-opted by the rich and the powerful and the mean-spirited, or is there some beneficial road like the one you just mentioned? I got to say, people were split with good reason, like on each side. But one of our fellows, Dr. Jasmine Kwasa, is at Carnegie Mellon, has done some work, and I don't want to raise it here, about the sort of systematic bias of particular electroencephalography and FNIRs, these devices that, for those who don't know, work by measuring electrical activity, and you describe it well in the book, but through the scalp. And the problem that Dr. Kwasa and others pointed out is that for almost the entirety of these technologies' existence, it was sort of overlooked that they were systematically excluding certain groups because of hair color. And so I want to ask about, like, who's included in this neurotechnology future, and how do we address this concern, which is clearly there because it's been there. It's almost every time a new technology, whether it's neuro or not, has shown up, but especially in neuroscience with our history of phrenology and its justification of a racial hierarchy. How do we, as in, and I guess who's the we also, but how do we address this? And are you concerned about it? How does that, again, that sort of racial inequity or concern about racial injustice play into this neurotechnology future or present?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I hear two different questions within what you asked, Frances. One of them is the validity of the data itself, given the populations that have been included within data sets that have analyzed electroencephalography and FNIRs. And the second is questions about who benefits from the technology, who's at risk from the technology, what are the kind of distributional concerns? Is that fair and kind of?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. And so let's start with the first one. And the first one, with respect to data validity, I mean, interestingly, every brain is a little bit different, and every brain requires calibration when you use these devices. They're not like there is some universality in terms of, you know, being able to like turn switches on and off with your brain, or concentration or alpha or beta, you know, kind of brain activity levels. But calibration is actually unique to each person when you use the devices. And so, you know, questions about the validity of the data as to whether or not like alpha really represents, you know, a particular thing, or gamma or delta, you know, brain waves and frequencies reflect different things. Those, I think, have been ecologically validated across a lot of different populations in terms of, is that really correlated with stress levels? Is that really correlated with attention and focus levels? That doesn't seem to vary, you know, based on, you know, who's included, excluded within the data set, because it has been replicated widely across now many different scalps and many different skin colors to use it. And it's also been, you know, calibrated with other modalities, and of course with clinical EEG, which has been much broader than, you know, the consumer-based EEG data sets. I'll also say that generative AI adds a really interesting dimension to this, because most of the neurotechnologists who I've been talking with have talked about how really generative AI will enable true customization to your own brain activity and calibration to your own brain activity. So I think, at least from an analytic or kind of clinical validity of the technology, who's included is anybody who wants to be included in the kind of absolute sense. So then we need to talk about it from the distributive justice sense, right? Which is who will have access to the technologies. I don't think this is that different than any other conversation. Meaning, I don't think that there's something unique or special or different about the distributive justice concerns when it comes to neurotechnologies than other technologies, in that the distributional concerns about the maldistribution of technologies, the maldistribution of benefits across society, the structural problems that that plays into, the hierarchy that that perpetuates, the hierarchies of informational asymmetries in the workplace, all of that, I think, exists across technologies. And so the reason it's not in this book uniquely, right, is not because I don't think it's an important part of the conversation. It's because in fashioning cognitive liberty exists within already other liberties and interests that are at play. I'm trying to kind of carve out what's unique in this space. And I'm not sure that I see that as being a unique issue within the space, but a pervasive issue that we have to address across society. And that's going to be true for, you know, AI and the power of AI and the tools and the availability of AI across society. The only way in which I think it starts to become unique is if you think that particular technologies are so transformational as to be critical to human flourishing. And to the extent that we believe that, right, if we believe like AI is crucial and access to it is crucial to human flourishing more so than other technologies, or neurotechnologies and access to it are crucial to human flourishing and more so than other technologies, then the urgency of addressing the distributional concerns within that technology become much more important. And I think you could make that case for neurotech, which is to say that because of its power and because of the fact that if it really does become the way in which people interface with other technologies, and substantially decreases the friction and increases the ease, or the enhancement potentials are substantially more powerful with neurotechnologies than other areas, then it becomes urgent that we address what is a pervasive issue in this context because of the unique benefits that it would provide to people.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let me ask about another pervasive issue that shows up here, and that has to do with the balance that you want to strike between sort of allowing individuals to flourish, but protecting them, right, from the harms. And in particular, I want to think about adolescence. So you argue that in general, respecting people's right to self-determination, including their right to enhance or diminish their brains, will further enable human flourishing. And sort of broadly with respect to giving consumers information, you argue that traditionalists are on the wrong side of history, the view that consumers are too health illiterate to justify their access, to justify self-access to their brains, belittles the average person and denies them the opportunity to become more educated. So I'm going to think about a hypothetical of 13-year-olds, because they
I really came out strongly on that one, didn't I, Francis? there are many that I'm like a little bit more hesitant, but on that one, that's like a very, that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, no, and I get it. I mean, it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. But then I thought, okay, but I'm thinking about it like me, you know, or 45-year-old me. But yeah. What about, and our your oldest are a little younger, ours is 11. We've all been through there, but age 13. So I picked 13 because it's PG-13. It's when Apple and others like begin to, you get to do certain things, but you're also, you're like 5 years away from 18, right? So you're not, what about that? It seems to me it's an example where there are many others, but there's one where there's this tension between trying to follow the sort of path to self-determination. And if I reread this sort of, many of us think that 13-year-olds are too health illiterate. I wouldn't.
Yeah, but I mean, so I would say I think children are different, right? I mean, so I'm fine with paternalism when it comes to children, because I think that's where paternalism plays its role. You're supposed to parent. And so making choices for children, like, I don't think that full self-determination at age 13 to do anything you want or have any kind of screen time you want or make any choices you want with respect to the use or misuse of technologies is within your hands. I don't think you have fully formed judgment to be making those choices yet. It's not about health literacy or illiteracy. It's about the fact that you are still being parented. And parenting, I think, is helping children to develop the capacity for self-determination over time as their judgment and their perspective develops. You know, so if you ask me at 13 whether or not I think that a child is too health illiterate to get direct access to information about their most serious medical conditions or what's happening in their own brains and whether parents can exercise choices in that instance, I think, yes, absolutely. I'm fine with that. If you want to talk to me about an adult making those choices and like somebody standing in the place of making a decision about what access to information they have about their own brains, then I think we're on the wrong side of history.
Okay, so I want to ask you about the middle, because I thought that might be your answer. And Yeah. And of course, you know, I thought of this. So there's all this neuroscience on the young adult brain. This is arguably the place, which you know really well, right? It's arguably the place that's been the most active. And there are a lot who argue that the 18-year-old, let's pick 18, because 18 now is a magical legal number.
Yes.
It's certainly a place where these technology companies are aware and are trying to, these are the consumers and they're targeting. Would part of the, how do we balance that in the law? That is, could we justify broader protections? But it would also limit what an 18-year-old could do, roughly on the argument that these technologies, which are specific to your neuron cells and the way they're operating and connecting together, we got to be really careful because we've learned a lot about how you're not fully wired. What about, is there, I mean, what do we do with that?
I mean, whether
it's TikTok or something, I mean, that's not the best example, but, you know, but to the firm who wants to put, you know, whatever the latest, greatest neurotech is in market 18. Could, should we prevent that? Should we wait till they're 25? Or do we let cognitive liberty, you know, protect their right to self-determination even at age 18? And then we'll go to audience questions to be my last one.
No, that's a great question, especially given that, you know, all of the neuroscience shows that, you know, you continue developing all the way through your mid-20s at least. And what I would say is this, which is we have drawn a rather arbitrary line in law around the age of 18 for a whole bunch of things, right? For voting, for, you know, being able to fight in wars, for, you know, what we determine to be a legal adult. And if we're going to maintain that line, which it seems like we are, then, you know, as the kind of legal fiction of when adulthood begins, I don't think that we ought to carve this category out uniquely to say, except for when it comes to information about your own brain, or except when it comes to choices around self-determination with respect to your own brain. And, you know, does that mean that we can't adopt different nudges or informational, you know, kind of campaigns to help a child understand that their brain continues to develop and that the impact, for example, as we learn about it, of, you know, screen addiction, or of, you know, the use of social media, which shapes and reshapes their brains in ways that can be devastating for self-esteem or can make them more likely to suffer from mental health issues, shouldn't be part of our education campaigns, or that we shouldn't go after companies, for example, who are intentionally trying to addict people to their platforms, recognizing that those have disproportionate effects on children. I think all of that is fair game, right? Meaning increased information forcing functions, try to get companies or create incentives or regulations around their you know, continued deployment of manipulative and addictive features that are embedded within technologies that disproportionately affect the youth. Whether we should then also take the next step, which is to say you can't have access to your own brain data, or you can't have access to the technologies until you're beyond 18, I would not favor that, largely because of where we've drawn the line on other kind of legal adulthood versus non-adulthood. Would I favor changing that line at some point, given what we know about the developing brain? Maybe. You know, I think the more we learn about the developing brain, the more it seems like we really have picked a pretty arbitrary point in time to carve out a bunch of different rights and regulations.
Thank you for that. So we're going to turn to audience questions now. If you weren't here at the beginning, you're welcome to put your questions in the Q&A. One question is the name of the book, The Battle for Your Brain, everywhere books are sold. It's great. So one of the questions here is a good one. It's about opting out. And the question is, what are the options for opting out of neurotechnologies? The context that questioner asks is, sometimes with our Fitbits, we can opt out of them. But with many of our phone collections, we tacitly accept a use agreement, and it's difficult to opt out. So how much data will be secretly collected by these neurotechnologies?
So first, I should say a lot of data is already being secretly collected, not through brain sensors, right? But, you know, much of the profiles that are being created about people through their digital activities are really designed to try to infer brains and mental experiences, right? People are trying to figure out what the emotional and you know, kind of cognitive landscape is of individuals, and then to use that for micro-targeting of advertisements or develop profiles and everything else about them. To the extent that you can opt out of a digital life, that's the extent to which you can opt out of all of that information being collected against you, which is to say you don't really have opt-out options. Brain sensors for the foreseeable future, I think, will be opt-outable. That is, you can buy, you know, AirPods that will have brain sensors, and you can buy AirPods that will not have brain sensors. And maybe not AirPods in particular, but earbuds, right? So you might choose to go with the company that does or doesn't have brain sensors in it, or you might choose headphones that do or don't have brain sensors in it, or the watch that does or doesn't. When it will become much more difficult to opt in and opt out is when it becomes the way in which we interface with all of the rest of our technology. And that's a future that many of these companies are really focused on building. So Meta plans to launch in 2025 its first watch for neural interface with its AR glasses. Now, that's a time frame that has been pushed a couple of times. Originally it was 2022 and then 2023, and now it's early 2025. So we'll see. But that's their current estimate, is that neural interface, the first iteration of it, will be early 2025. By the end of, I think, the decade, we can expect that it'll be increasingly more difficult to interface with virtual reality and augmented reality without sensors as the way in which you interface with those technologies. And so I think, you know, whether it's AR, VR, or like, I heard a presentation at TED last week around Humane, which is screenless technology that is your AI that senses your everyday activity. I think increasingly all of that will be integrated with sensors that detect brain and other biometric activity, which will become very hard to opt out of. To the extent that you want to have a digital life, it'll be harder and harder, which is why I think it's so important that we really get out ahead of that moment of ubiquity, is to give people that option to be able to opt out. And, you know, I'll just say chapter two of the book focuses on your brain at work. And I think that's going to become a place in which it'll become harder and harder to opt out as well, is the extent to which that's integrated into everyday workplace for cognitive ergonomics, that is the adaptive workplace to the brain, or self-tracking of focus, or tracking that is not self-tracking but mandated by employers.
Thanks for that. I want to combine a couple of questions. In the final chapter towards the end of the book, you talk about looking for a universal human right as part of the solution. Two of our questions are raising other legal avenues, which could be complementary or substitutes. One from Adam Steiner asked about data ownership. And some, as you know, have argued both on both sides that property law and data ownership of brain data might be one option. Danielle Torino asked, says also she loves your book, and what are suggestions around writing data use agreements or informed consent? It's almost a contractual mechanism to deal with this. So could you talk a little bit about the different legal avenues that might be available and how you see them working independently or together?
Yeah. So I'm advocating for cognitive liberty as a universal human right, but it's not the only approach to it, right? And I'm not the only person who's either writing about cognitive liberty or kind of developing the normative frameworks and theories around it. This is my take on how we ought to recognize it and how we ought to integrate it and what the normative case for it ought to be. The reason I locate it within international human rights law is because, first, I think it's an international global right that we need to recognize that I think has significant both legal power to recognize it internationally, but also has significant norm potential as well. So setting it as both a legal as well as a societal norm of recognize the importance of cognitive liberty, I think is foundational. And the mechanism by which I suggest that we do that is by recognizing it has three different components which exist and are reflected within international human rights law. That is to update privacy to include mental privacy, and I describe which aspects of our cognitive and affective experiences would be covered by that, to update freedom of thought to go beyond religious freedom and belief and to include freedom from interception, manipulation, and punishment of our thoughts. And that builds on the work of Dr. Ahmed Shaheed, who was the special rapporteur of freedom of thought and held the mandate previously. And the last is self-determination, which is this kind of positive aspect of it. But to your question specifically about other mechanisms by which that would be implemented, I see that both as an international right, but then requiring both national legislation and context-specific legislation. So context-specific could include things like employment law that needs to specifically address, you know, the collection of biometric data and particularly brain biometric data within the workplace and what that means and what rights individuals have and when mental privacy might yield, for example, to societal interests in certain contexts. The other aspect of it is things like data use and data agreements. And so the GDPR addresses some aspects of data use. There are different laws within the United States in different jurisdictions that address biometric collection and use. And the question is whether or not we treat this as being part of those bigger biometric laws, if we carve out something as uniquely sensitive with respect to brain data, or if we focus instead on the inferences that can be drawn from different kinds of data to get at brains and mental experiences. I favor this last category as the way to think about it, which is inferences that can be drawn. But I also think that there's something unique about accessing directly brain activity and the chilling effect that that has on people. And so I talk about that as one of the aspects that we need to think about. And I'll just put on the table, which is I was talking with the founder of OpenBCI last week, and we were talking about, you know, what might data use agreements look like that companies could adopt, which would give people personal control over their data, but still enable them to share with researchers and scientists for the aggregation of data for, you know, being able to discover a lot more about our brains and to be able to solve many of the issues that arise from neurological disease and suffering. And I think a lot of people within the neurotech industry are exploring that option, which is to figure out what could we do to give people kind of personal, whether it's through Web3 or blockchain or other, you know, kind of options, personal control over brain data that they could then share through interoperability and standards that might be set to enable those additional insights.
Yeah, I think my view is, you know, a combination, as you say, of these things is going to be needed. And of course, country specific, culture specific, the like. Speaking of different cultures, there are two questions here that I think I'm going to pair together. And the first question, which comes from Anushka Dadlani, asked, could you talk about how advances in neurotech could impact, benefit advances in other scientific fields, specifically anti-aging and human longevity? And there was an additional question from anonymous attendee, which asked, have you run these ideas past older adults? And I'm curious about both of them. Like, they're not the exact same question, but they're kind of in the same bucket. I asked you the question about developing brains, so let's look at...
What was the first question? The second question is around senior citizens, but...
Yeah, and the first question here is about the implications of neurotech for really anti-aging, human longevity.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that stuff's interesting, right? In the last, or second to last chapter of the book, Beyond Human, I do talk about some of the possibilities of human longevity, whether that's through things like brain uploading that people have described, or some of the really innovative work like Ninad Sestin and his team's work on Brain X to be able to figure out if there are aspects of the human brain and damage that occurs over time that could be reversed. Even questions about different aspects of the brain where we start to see deterioration over time, whether it's through neurodegenerative diseases or, you know, things like glutathione and its depletion over time, and whether the more we learn about the brain and the more brain sensors, for example, are used in everyday life, if we might not gain insights that would enable us to be able to address a lot of these questions with respect to human longevity, both the causes, potentially treatments, and reversibility of it. I have talked to seniors, and it's interesting because I think the most common response I get from them is, thank goodness I will not be alive to see some of these changes. I think people quickly see the dystopian side of it, and it's harder for people to imagine that the promise really will outweigh the risks. And that is a possibility, right? I mean, it is possible that it will become so dystopian that it is hard for us to actually achieve a vision of the world where we realize the benefits of it. I'm hopeful that we can get out ahead of it so that that's not the case. I'm hopeful that the benefits to brain health and wellness and addressing and understanding the burden and toll of neurological disease and suffering that we could discover through this technology are promising enough that we can realize that future. But that's the most common response. Thank goodness I will not be alive for it.
Well, you may be. I mean, you consider yourself, are you a futurist? I've seen that in your bio sometimes. You are, yeah. So, I mean, you might radical life extension.
In that way. I mean, I'm a futurist and, you know, I sort of realized finally that that's what I am, which is, you know, the first thing that I did when I graduated from college is I worked at a strategy consulting company. And for 3 years, what they taught me were tools of forecasting, from trend analysis to, you know, mathematical modeling to, you know, being able to estimate and understand the size of industries and the direction and how to track the different metrics of progress and in a field. And I've been applying that throughout my career to, you know, technological development and scientific development across genomics and AI and neurotech. And I finally realized, oh, that's futurism, is that kind of, you know, methodological and analytical forecasting of where things are going. It's just I combine that futurism with trying to then understand the legal and ethical implications and how we might get out ahead of it. But that's what I'm really drawn to is the directionality of change in technologies and forecasting more so than, you know, kind of technologies that are already here and spending a lot of time thinking about those. I think there's kind of a place for each of us in that landscape. And mine is I like thinking about where things are going and trying to help to assess it.
If I could pick up on that thread, a couple of questions from students have basically asked some version of, okay, so what might careers look like in the new world you're painting? Slash, what I would ask is, how do we train the next generation of, and I don't even know what the fields are exactly, how you would fill that in, to help us take the right fork and the right path as we appreciate this fork? And maybe you can talk about your own background, which is really interdisciplinary. I mean, you're ostensibly a law professor, but not like most law professors. You're doing all these amazing things. You run a lab. You run all of like Duke Science and Society. So maybe there's part bio question in there too, but just it feels like for these new challenges, we need to rethink a little bit about how we're preparing our next generation. I wonder if you can talk about that and any concrete advice you'd have for students who are on this webinar now, kind of getting excited about what you're saying and wanting to do something.
So I say you and I are both weird in that regard, Francis. The kind of careers.
That's why they put us together here.
Right. So I think this is one that we could take together in talking about different ways to be able to shape your career path, because, you know, we both, I think, have developed labs and, you know, work on different government entities. And, you know, I work with companies and I suspect you do as well, and kind of helping to advise them about the ethical pathway forward. And also I'm a law professor who runs and founded Duke Science and Society. I think there's a lot of different ways to come at the problem, and I'd be interested in your reflections on the same, which is I've always been interested in the intersection between the legal, the kind of normative, and the science and the technology. And so that's really my scientific, legal, and philosophical background, was bringing those different disciplines together and then looking at the issue at the intersection of them. But, you know, there are a huge number of questions to be asked from the technological side, from the privacy scholar side, from the cybersecurity side, from the, sociology of all of this, from cultural anthropology, from the history, and being able to use history to both inform the future of it. I think there isn't a right pathway forward. It's a uniquely interdisciplinary space where a lot of different voices need to come together, you know, to help understand that the clinical side, the physician side, the patient advocacy side, the democratic deliberation and policymaker side. So I think it's finding your passion. And for me, my passion was trying to address the intersection of these questions in a particular way. And that's what drove me for the degrees that I got and for the opportunities that I've taken on. But it's figuring out what drives you, what questions drive you, what impact you want to have, and what kind of contribution you want to make as a result, and from what angle you want to do it. But I don't know, you also are weird like me. So what do you think?
I concur with everything you said. I actually would, again, I really like, as I mentioned at the outset, that your book is not, you're a futurist. You're not attacking the technology as a bad thing. And you have multiple examples where through conversations, you're working with these companies, you know, and now helping them, I think, to see things. Maybe there's just one exchange where you say, well, what are these ethics? Never thought of that, right? And so you're helping them to think about these things. And I think going into it in a collaborative tone is just so, so important. But collaborative, but you're also standing up for what you would want us to have as a universal human right. So we might have time for a couple more audience questions, but I want to get one more in, and you'd know I'd asked about the criminal justice system, I'm sure. So I want to read, this is the end of this chapter, The Last Fortress, and you argue that mental privacy is a critical aspect of cognitive liberty, but like all privacy interests, it is not absolute. People can and should have the right to give others access to their brain activity. There will be times when we want to do so to promote research and earn exchanges for goods and services. And here's what I want to get to. There will be times that society will demand the tracking of our brain activity when the lives or others are at risk. So I see this playing out already, actually, in the criminal justice system. I see some people have called it digital prisons. Others, probably me, see it as a much more humane future than locking people up. But I'm wondering what you think about how we balance this right to cognitive liberty for someone who has done some act of interpersonal violence, who has some history of serious mental illness, who's now being released back into society. And we have the opportunity for the first time ever not to rely on like check-ins with the parole officer every 2 weeks, but to get 24/7 data on this individual. We might be able to see the volcano before it erupts. But of course, that sounds Is that dystopian? Is that utopian? Like, how do you think about this balancing of rights specifically in the criminal justice domain?
Yeah, it's both, right? It's dystopian and utopian. And, you know, it's always important with emerging tech to look at it compared to the status quo, right? And I think a lot of times people look at technology in a vacuum rather than by what we're already doing. Right. I mean, automated vehicles isn't, you know, and kind of self-driving vehicles is a good comparison to that, which is like, yeah, they sometimes get into accidents and so do humans. And so then the question is, you know, are they worse? Are they better? Are they better than the status quo? And, you know, right now we do really dystopian things to prisoners, solitary confinement and prison conditions and people who are mentally ill, not getting any of the resources and help that they need. And people who are, you know, deeply, you know, addicted to drugs and other, you know, devices, or children who are being sent away for life. And all of that to me is horrific in the way in which we actually currently approach justice. And so the question is, can neurotech help? And in some ways it can. It can both help us understand what we're doing, right? The research itself can help us understand what is the impact of solitary confinement? What is the impact on prison? What is the impact of the different choices that we're making? And then this kind of idea of tracking, right, whether it's ankle bracelets or, you know, other forms of brain sensing tracking or even moral rehabilitation. Could that be done well? It could be. Could it be done in horrific ways that overwrite people's brains, overwrite their autonomy, violate their cognitive liberty and become deeply problematic? Yes. You do lose some liberty rights when you commit a crime. And society, I think, has a right to deprive you of some aspects of your liberty when you have committed a crime, especially a violent crime against another person. And since these rights, since cognitive liberty is not an absolute right, but a relative right, figuring out where we're going to carve out that balance between liberty, you know, that you have given up as a result of committing a crime versus how much we can take from you. In a sense, like how much we're justified in taking from you and how intrusive it is with the mechanisms that we imagine in digital prisons or otherwise. I think that's, you know, we're going to have to figure that out. We're going to figure out both what the technology can do and when it's justified. But sometimes by comparison to the status quo, it may be better than what we're currently doing.
I think we probably have time for one more audience question. I'll ask this question from Federico Fernandez Kepka. And I think it reflects probably some questions that others have. So the question is, do you think that accepting these neurotechnologies would create an issue of over-medicalizing the brain and begin a path to create an ideal brain or incentivize a certain type of brain activity and stigmatize other types of brain activity? Which I guess is...
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Thank you. This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
A no-no, we're cool.